Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we approach the end of the year, GLT is looking back on some of the stories and interviews from 2018. Today, we bring you an encore edition of our show on the advent of autonomous vehicles. Before Illinois roads are filled with driverless cars, there will be years and years of testing. Toes dipped in the water, half measures that become full measures. Earlier this year, the Illinois Department of Transportation announced a new autonomous vehicle testing program. It's aimed at catching Illinois up with other states like California and Arizona, already well known for their openness to self-driving cars. GLT's Ryan Denham used a very low level of autonomy, cruise control, for a road trip to Springfield for this conversation with Matt McInerney, lead project manager for IDOT's Automated and Connected Vehicle Initiative. He says it's all about safety.
You know, we've seen the safety numbers in the state kind of trending in the wrong direction, where we've topped 1,000 fatalities on the road for 2 years now, trending in that direction again this year. So that's really what sparked this. You know, Secretary Blankenhorn, you know, has made a really concerted effort to look at, a whole host of ways, you know, to make our roads safer. And this is one of those things. You know, we really think at the end of the day, obviously there's some room to go still to grow in this area. But we think through proper development, these systems eventually are going to, you know, make our roads a whole lot safer than they are today.
How will this testing program work?
So really, we just wanted to provide a baseline, you know, a starting point to say, okay, this is what the law says right now. This is what's going on out there. Let's start collecting some information until, you know, we can work with, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to need to be work with the legislature to get some legislation to do some more comprehensive stuff. But the testing program we set up just sets a starting point where we can gather some general information so we can communicate with local communities, local law enforcement, you know, folks where this testing may be going on in their jurisdictions who may not know now. You know, so it's really just an opportunity to provide better communication and start, you know, some of this collaboration that needs to go on. You know, this is going to take some, you know, really extraordinary work between a lot of different groups. And I think, you know, our testing program is a starting point for that.
So you talked about the importance of gathering information. Is there also a way for communities that are interested in participating in testing or having a company come in and test in their area? Is there a way for them to, like, raise their hand and say, yes, we would like someone to come in and we're open to that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the process we hope to set out. You know, if you go to our website, which we've set up through IDOT, and that provides some contact information, I think we are probably going to put something in there to allow communities. But we definitely want communities to reach out. You know, this is a big part. We know, you know, there are communities who are interested in hosting testing. And we know there's communities that aren't interested. But for those that are, you know, we've obviously established some, you know, good communication channels with businesses and companies who are operating in this space, and we'd love, you know, to provide, you know, to certain communities who are interested, you know, with the opportunity to do what's best for them, you know. And I think that's the big thing here is, you know, it's going to be different for every community, you know, what their interests are. Some are going to be worried about safety. Obviously, we're all worried about safety, but I think some, you know, will look at it as an economic development, you know, arm. Some will look at it as a way to reduce congestion and things like that.
So for listeners out there, there are various levels of autonomous driving, from as basic as cruise control up to, you know, something you might picture in your head from a futuristic Hollywood movie or something where there's no driver involvement at all. Mm-hmm. What does state law allow for at this point, and at what level would a change in state law be required if the state wanted to go beyond that?
Yeah, so it's our interpretation, you know, and it's been interpreted differently state to state, you know, and that's one of the issues we're seeing is this, what they call that patchwork of regulations. But from the way we looked at the current law, you know, the current law basically just says have a properly licensed driver behind the wheel. And so that's what our program allows currently. So to take that the step further, which eventually is going to happen, to get to a more driverless, you know, operation, which would, you know, under those levels you were talking about would be technically kind of level 4 and then level 5. you know, we do need to address some statutes. So ours allows what they call right now level three, which is conditional automation. So in that level, you know, there needs to be a human driver as kind of the fallback, you know, if a situation arises that the vehicle cannot handle. So that's what we're set up for now is that level three operation.
In looking at the executive order and the announcement recently about this initiative, it talks about wanting to be a leader in this arena. So I want to ask, before now, was Illinois at risk of falling behind what other states were doing when it comes to testing? I mean, states like California, Arizona, that are a bit, you know, maybe more known for this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I think that's, you know, again, Secretary Blankenhorn's, you know, been very out front on that. You know, we do want to be a leader in this. We think, you know, we hold a natural position where we should be a leader in this. You know, we hold a key place in the country, especially as it relates to our freight movement. You know, we're kind of that central hub of freight throughout North America. So we definitely saw opportunity there. But we did see, you know, the industry moving really quickly. And we think it's important. You know, I like to say we're probably in the first inning right now, but the game has started. So you can either, you know, be a fan on the sidelines or you can be in the ball game. And we felt we needed to be in the game. So things have progressed quickly. You know, it's moved out. Obviously, as you mentioned, it started kind of in the West Coast, California, Nevada, Arizona played key parts. But now you're seeing Ohio, you know, really start to, you know, kind of ramp up their activities. Pittsburgh's obviously been a hub for some time. Obviously, Detroit is in the heart of it. So it is starting to filter more outside of the coast and into the Midwest. And we think it's important that we're a part of that, you know, process and development.
So what are some things that you and IDOT learned from those other places, other states, other cities, as you were sketching out your own version of this kind of testing program?
You know, we learned a lot. We scoured basically every program out there. You know, we reached out and had conversations with a lot of the different state DOTs and their people who are running their programs and gathered a whole lot of information. So we definitely took a lot of lessons from those folks, some good, some bad. You know, we tried to, you know, figure out those best practices. And we did end up, you know, at the end of the day, again, providing a starting point for the state. We know more needs to be done, but our starting point did, you know, come a lot from what we saw in those other states.
Can you think of an example maybe of a good lesson or a bad lesson that you maybe took away from somewhere else that you brought into this program?
You know, I would say a good lesson that we took as we looked at this is kind of a tech neutral approach. You know, we came out early and said we didn't want to pick or choose a winner or a loser in terms of the technology. And that, you know, kind of started from the beginning. A lot of folks had that, you know, kind of base as where they were starting from. And that's what we wanted to make sure we were providing. So we did learn some lessons there. You know, there was some legislation introduced that, you know, would have essentially kind of boxed out some of the bigger players, some of your tech companies. And we thought it was just important to have them, you know, at the table and being able to participate, as obviously they're greatly contributing to this industry. So that was definitely a lesson we wanted to make sure we put into place is, you know, kind of a tech neutral approach. And the feds have kind of reaffirmed that recently in their latest guidance that, you know, they're kind of taking a similar approach. So we're in line with, I think, with where everybody else is approaching this at this point.
Bloomington Normal, our area, has an electric vehicle manufacturer called Rivian that wants to introduce some pretty serious autonomous driving capability into its first launch vehicles. Have you had conversations with Rivian? Have they raised their hand in any meaningful way to be kind of part of what you guys are working on here?
Yeah, you know, we've talked to Rivian. We've talked to a lot of companies, a lot of Illinois-based companies. You know, we're excited about Rivian and what their future holds, and we're, you know, aware of their ambitions to provide some autonomous, you know, features to their vehicles. You know, they're part of the Illinois AV Association, who we've worked with as well. So, we've had great conversations with them, you know, and like I said, you know, we're looking to provide a level playing field for everybody, Rivian included.
Illinois is obviously a big state, but it's like a very diverse state in terms of driving environments. You've got Chicago, very urban. You've got places like Bloomington Normal, which got urban, but then surrounded very nearby with rural areas, with interstates crisscrossing through it. Where do you think this testing might take off first? Is it going to be in more kind of urban environments like up in Chicago? more in the interstates that IDOT is so closely associated with, more smaller communities like Bloomington, Decatur, Springfield? What do you kind of see there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our hope is we see a variety. I mean, I think that's one of Illinois' attractive points here. You know, we do have four seasons. You know, we do have some, you know, climate that some of those West Coast states do not. So we do think that makes us attractive. Like you mentioned, we do have the urban, suburban, kind of rural settings. Each one of those are, you know, there are certain folks focusing on each one of those. So we hope to attract a variety of them. You know, we do think, you know, freight, when you look at kind of what's coming more immediate and what's coming longer out, you know, some of the freight applications we are seeing, you know, more frequently. And we think those are developing pretty quickly. I definitely think we'll have some freight, you know, opportunities that we hope to see going here. But, you know, obviously the city of Chicago is going to be, a big target for a lot of companies who look to get in there. But, you know, I know the city just started a task force and they're kind of exploring that issue as well from their end. So I don't fully want to speak for the city in terms of what their plans are. But, you know, we think it's going to be a variety, though. I wouldn't say any one over the other. But, you know, we've taken a keen interest in the freight side of things.
So in other states, public universities have become sort of a central part of the autonomous driving exploration. University of Michigan is a pretty notable example. Where do you see Illinois public universities getting involved in all this?
The universities, again, played an important role to get us to this point, and we foresee that, filling out even further. We're exploring the idea of a test track in the Rantoul area through the University of Illinois, Northwestern, and UIC. They've provided valuable input. We've explored some different, things with Bradley. You know, Bradley just started a new robotics engineering program there. We've talked to Dr. Karat, who's been a big leader in that. So, we know how important they are, especially at this stage, as a lot of research and development and things are going on. So we intend to continue those close conversations that we've had with them, and I expect them to continue to play a major role in a lot of the things we do.
What about Illinois State Police? How do they are they directly involved with this initiative, and if so, how so?
They have. It'll be 2 years ago March, we formed kind of a informal kind of interagency working group. One of the things we learned very on in this is much bigger than just DOT. This has to have a broad coalition of agencies working together. So we did bring together, under Secretary Blankenhorn's guidance, a six-agency kind of interagency working group. ISP was part of that and has been from the beginning. They see it as a safety thing. They're excited about the safety prospects. Those troopers out there on the roads, see firsthand how dangerous the roads can be.
Well, I imagine one of the six agencies in that working group was the Illinois Department of Insurance, which has a regulatory role over companies like some of our biggest employers in Bloomington, Normal, sure. State Farm and Country Financial. Can you talk about what role Department of Insurance is playing and what interest insurers may have in this world?
Obviously, this is going to change the insurance industry pretty drastically at the end of the day. But everybody, where we're at, everybody's still trying to figure out how, when, and what, in what capacity. But they've been a part of that working group I just spoke of from the beginning as well. So they've had, their input. And we hope, through a lot of these new initiatives to kind of further that. I know State Farm has been a big leader in this from the insurance side, and we're lucky to have them in our backyard. So they're going to be a great resource. So we have Allstate as well in the state. So two of the major insurance players who have invested a lot of money to figure this out. We look forward, as we move forward, working with, all of them and the Department of Insurance more.
Matt is right. At first blush, self-driving technology can be a scary proposition for an insurance industry's bottom line. It holds the promise of a world without crashes. No crashes, though, mean no claims, no insurance, and that means no State Farm insurance. Ryan Gammelgaard is one of State Farm's top voices on autonomous vehicles. He's a lawyer doing public policy work for the Bloomington-based insurer, and Gammelgaard tells GLT's Ryan Denham the insurance industry has ratcheted up interest in autonomous vehicles in the last 2 to 3 years.
We almost had this existential crisis in the insurance industry. No accidents, no crashes will mean there's no need for insurance policies. And so people got really kind of concerned. What do we do about this? And then, fast forward to today, and I think you have started to realize that there will continue to be crashes. This technology is not going to be perfect. And it's going to be a long time before you get a critical mass of these vehicles on the road. And so from a State Farm perspective, we look at it as an opportunity, right? We've always been supportive of technologies that help enhance safety, make our customers' lives safer and better. And we see great promise in this technology as long as it's done right.
Regardless, it will change the business model in some ways, right? And can you talk a little bit about in what ways you think it will change State Farm's business model and the products that you guys offer, even if it's not an existential crisis?
Sure. Well, so from a State Farm perspective, you know, we look at some of our current products that are out there right now and some that are now being more focused on the concept of personal mobility. So I'm in college or I'm just getting out of college and I'm living in a big city and I have no desire to own a car for the next 5 or 10 years. I still am going to need coverage when I get from point A to point B on my journey throughout the day. And so we have some products that we've developed that help address that type of coverage that are slowly being rolled out across the country. I think you can kind of start to see more creative approaches to insurance. The natural question that I think that comes out of automated vehicles is, do you start to see a shift from more of the traditional liability where you're insuring a vehicle or the individual and now into more of a product liability issue? Are you insuring fleets of vehicles as opposed to just an individual vehicle? And so I think if you look at State Farm, right, our primary business is the personal automobile, right? And so will there be a shift? Well, I think it's natural. There's going to be a natural shift if more of these vehicles are owned by manufacturers or owned by fleets. Ideally, we're going to play a part in that. And so there might be a small shift or some shift toward that. I do still think it's too early to tell, though. I kind of, and this is me speaking as opposed to State Farm, but I envision a future where there's going to be a lot of different options on the table. I don't think it's going to be a binary, you're either in an automated vehicle or you're not. I just think there's going to be a lot of choices as to how we get around. And I think the insurance products that we create and other insurance companies create are going to reflect that reality.
Yeah, and what are some of those historical parallels or analogs to the self-driving technology that State Farm has seen over the years?
Yeah, so I think seatbelts and airbags are a great example of this. Right. So when federal government passed some rules and regulations mandating that these different passive restraints or seatbelts and airbags were put in vehicles, the initial thinking would be, well, that means that there's going to be less crashes. To the degree there are crashes, less losses. And then the government actually pulled back that rule. They rescinded that rule. And State Farm ended up suing the federal government to make sure that they would implement that rule. Because we were so focused on the safety of our customers and the safety of the public and realized that, look, long term, there's still going to be insurance coverage, right? There's still going to be risks that we need to manage. And here we are today, and those seatbelts, airbags have saved countless lives, right? And at the same time, insurance industry is just as strong as ever.
Automated vehicles certainly have the potential to increase safety, I think, long term. Maybe fewer accidents, fewer bad accidents. But what are some of the risk areas? Is there a potential for increased risk, maybe even in the short term, mm-hmm. where you have more automated vehicles on the roads, but you also still have people behind the wheel of other vehicles?
Yeah. So in the short term, if we look at where these vehicles are on the road today, so Waymo does a lot of testing in California, for example, and also in Arizona. What you tend to find is, at least what they report, when there are crashes, the majority of the time, it's not the fault of the automated vehicle. It's the fault of somebody else driving. And that tends to be because these vehicles are programmed to follow the strict letter of the law, right? So they're not, if it's a 35-mile-per-hour lane, they're not going to go 1 mile per hour over that. But we know from driving every day that that's not how real life works, right? So there's going to be this tricky kind of transition period where you're going to start to see more and more, you know, level 4 and level 5 vehicles on the road that really are doing most of the driving. And then you're going to have, you know, humans that are doing the rest of it. And so some of the evidence at this point in time indicates that that is going to be somewhat of a rough transition. And it's going to be because of automated vehicles follow the letter of the law and humans sometimes don't. And so that's definitely one concern that we have right now.
So what are some of the public policy positions that State Farm has taken that relate to automated vehicles?
Yeah, so first and foremost, and this is the guiding principle, right, is we support technology that advances and enhances our customer safety. And so we're never going to waver from that. But I'd say in terms of prioritization after that, really big point for us is data access. And so if you think about the fact that there might not be a driver in a driverless vehicle or a fully automated vehicle, what happens when there is a crash? Who's the witness to that? Are we going to be able to pull together relevant evidence and information to determine who is liable for that crash and who's at fault? These are key pieces of information that we currently can use in vehicles that are equipped with event data recorders today, for example. But there has been some resistance in the manufacturing and tech industries on this notion that insurance companies can get access to critical crash-related data. Their position is that's proprietary information, right? And so if you start to gather some of that, then somehow you're going to figure out how their vehicles operate, what makes their operating system special. Our position is we don't care about that. We're not concerned about the proprietary information. What we are concerned about, if there is a crash, who's responsible for that? What are the different pieces of information and data can we use to figure out who's really at fault? And you know what? If the promise is that this technology is safer than humans, then I think we think that they should be willing to share that information. But that's a really critical discussion right now. And there's been a lot of back and forth at the state level and at the federal level on that specific issue.
So more and more states are now allowing automated vehicle testing. Illinois just launched its own program. States like California, Arizona, et cetera. States are at different points on this spectrum of allowing testing and encouraging this exploration. So what about the role of the federal government in this? Do you think that the federal government will need to step in and clarify some sort of nationwide approach to this at some point? Or could this honestly move along on a state-by-state basis?
Yeah, so State Farm's position, and this is echoed throughout the insurance industry, is to continue to have the federal government really outline the safety and operational designs of these vehicles. And that kind of plays into the whole data access piece that we were talking about earlier. But we do think that a consistent approach to kind of setting safety standards is a good thing, right? You don't necessarily want a 50-state patchwork that says in one state, it's a free-for-all, but in the next state, you have to have 5 safety engineers in the front seat of one of these vehicles. That kind of defeats the purpose. And so, again, we do look to the federal government to kind of outline safety and operational design issues. From a state perspective, though, we are supportive of the states continuing to play a role in this. So licensing, insurance issues, where the vehicles can actually operate in a state, we're supportive of that. And to some degree, that's actually consistent with how things are done today.
So it seems like the legal risks of automated vehicles can be a little bit overwhelming. You can say an early stage automated vehicle malfunctions and somebody gets killed in some state across the country. I mean, doesn't that run the risk of potentially derailing this whole movement to some degree?
Well, we've actually seen that this year, right? So in Arizona, there was the incident with the Uber where somebody lost their lives because Uber, when they were testing this, deactivated some components on that vehicle and it ended up causing a fatality. That in turn had the impact of stalling some U.S. Senate legislation that I think about, if you went back to the beginning of this year, pretty much everybody working in this space thought was going to pass. But when that Uber incident happened, that really put the brakes on some federal legislation. And now that we have a new House coming into play in the mix, we're probably looking at, starting in 2019, a completely different package of proposed federal legislation. To your question about if there is an accident or a crash, does that threaten to kind of derail the advancements of this technology? Yeah, we're seeing that actually in practice. Now, in the same time, it hasn't slowed down the money that's being invested in this from the tech companies, suppliers, and auto manufacturers. They took kind of a quick pause, collected their thoughts, said we need to do a better job at this, but they're still dumping tens of billions of dollars, if not more, into developing this technology. The only thing that has really kind of slowed a little bit is the regulations that are being considered.
That's Ryan Gammelgaard, counsel in the Public Policy Resource Group at State Farm, speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, with Doctors Brownstone, Crockett, Pinter, and Vise, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for more than 30 years. Routine vision care also available. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with an encore edition of GLT's show on self-driving vehicles. Illinois lawmakers are also among those stakeholders trying to figure out how to best position their state to get economic opportunities, but also how to take a common-sense approach to regulation and public safety while moving toward people sharing the road with autonomous vehicles. State Representative Tom Demmer represents the 90th District in North Central Illinois. He is a co-sponsor of the early legislation already made law on this topic. Demmer says the debate is not particularly partisan, but it is complicated.
The manufacturers of automobiles, the traditional manufacturers, some new startup people, people who work on some of the technology of it, so think of the software or the camera systems. There are a lot of different stakeholders here. And then add to that people who use the roadways today, both drivers, services providers, the Secretary of State's office, groups like motorcycle advocacy groups, pedestrian, bicycle advocacy groups, public transportation groups.
Demmer says he favors an incremental approach, step by step, with a light touch. He says chances are if you guess how the technology will affect people's lives, you will guess wrong and will have to undo the regulation. Demmer says initial policies should include how to do testing, where to test, where does the liability lie during testing, the manufacturer, the software. He says he hopes they're not far from that.
Less than a couple years. I think we're at a point where if we sort of agree on the scope of limiting it, I think we could get something done in the next year.
And it's not just the car makers regulators should be paying attention to. State Representative Mike Fortner of West Chicago is also a co-sponsor of existing Illinois regulation. He says Caterpillar's been working on autonomous vehicles in its mining operations for decades. Agriculture implements are also very programmable right now. Fortner says there are different evolutionary tracks for autonomous vehicles, including experiments in other countries.
We have a lead truck with a human driver and other trucks that are designed to follow. I don't think anyone's looking at that in the U.S. yet.
Fortner says one thing he does not want to see in legislation is a patchwork of local rules. He says the state needs a framework to move ahead, but not the final commandments.
You know, one only needs to look at the way our state law has had to catch up on various aspects of privacy law, where we had to catch up on even securing our election systems. Technology moves in these jumps. We know that type of technology is coming, and we want to be thinking about that.
Rivian Automotive CEO RJ Scaringe has talked about a future that includes new models of ownership. Right now, most people have a car sitting around their garage a lot of the time. It's convenient when you want to use it, but most of the time it's parked. Scaringe says if autonomous vehicles can come get you without involving the cost of a human driver, people might not need to buy the whole vehicle, just a subscription to it. Fortner says lawmakers have already passed regulation on that issue even before true driverless vehicles are here.
Who owns the vehicle? Is it more like a car rental situation or more like a private ownership situation? The technology sometimes makes that a gray area, and then we find competing stakeholders and have to try to see, is there a solution that resolves the differences between those stakeholders? Much like we're seeing right now, the bill dealing with car sharing.
One voice that perhaps has not been as present in the discussion of regulation and development of driverless vehicles yet is the voice of philosophers and ethicists. Janet Fleetwood hails from the field of public health ethics. She teaches at Drexel University. Several years ago, Fleetwood wrote a widely circulated article announcing alarm about who is making the choices in programming autonomous vehicles.
I think we need the engagement of public health experts, ethics experts, community members in the communities where these are being tested, and legislators in order to come up with those criteria, but they're by no means settled upon yet. I think that's why it's so distressing that they're being rolled out in advance of a lot of analysis of these issues.
In philosophy, there's something called the trolley problem. How does a trolley driver choose which track to go down when one has five people standing on it and the other has one?
But there are lots of other issues as well. There are impacts on a community. There's questions of fairness as far as long-term access to autonomous vehicles and who will have access. Will it be only for the rich who can afford to buy them? Will they be used as some form of public transportation? And if so, will it be more reasonable in cost to enable disenfranchised people and vulnerable populations to use them? Will they, unfortunately, replace our focus on public transportation?
Waymo already has a couple billion hours of simulated driving time for its software and some millions of over-the-road hours in California and Arizona. Fleetwood says it takes more than engineers to write software that has moral implications in how a vehicle responds. Of course, debates over new technology and automation are not new. Really not new. David Gunkel studies the philosophy and ethics of technology at Northern Illinois University.
It goes way back to Plato in one of the dialogues, the Phaedrus, in which people involved in the conversation were worried about writing as an autonomous kind of memory that would be disembodied from human beings. And as a result, it would threaten, you know, certain sort of standards for how we understand human communication and interaction.
Writing did transform civilization. And Gunkel says eventually became a cornerstone of human life. He sees the uncertainty and questions about autonomous vehicles playing out the same way. After much uncertainty, people will get used to this latest new thing. It'll be complicated, though. Gunkel says a lawyer once told him technology moves at light speed and regulation moves at pen and paper speed. He also says legal culture plays a big role in how that happens, and slow can be considered a feature, not a bug, depending on your view.
For example, in Europe, where law is more statutory than it is common law-based, there's a great deal of effort to try to get out in front of this, to write laws in advance of an accident occurring. Whereas in the United States, where we have a common law practice, there is a more of a wait-and-see approach that says, you know, let's wait and see what happens with technology, and then we'll let the courts sort of sort it out and develop precedent and let law evolve.
Gunkel agrees with Fleetwood that interdisciplinary dialogue is key.
Engineers are problem solvers, right? So you give an engineer a problem, and they will find the shortest route to a possible solution. That route to that solution may have other consequences that are not necessarily factored into the decision-making process. And that is, I think, where the ethicists and the philosophers have something to contribute, because their job is to weigh all the various factors involved, from social aspects to psychological aspects to cultural aspects.
In some spaces, the conversation is happening. Gunkel says Google early on had philosophers at the table talking about moral issues with self-driving vehicles. In other places, he says the conversations are not as robust.
China is making a big play for AI. They would like to be the world leader in artificial intelligence in the coming decades. And one of the concerns is that their sort of mode of operating in the AI area tends to favor the STEM fields and seems to be less interested in talking to the humanists and the social scientists.
Gunkel says the European Union is on the other end of that spectrum, deeply considering social costs. That could include significant job destruction, say, if you don't need drivers for as many vehicles, or at all for long-haul trucking. The question who decides who wins and loses, whose life gets valued higher, happens at a societal level and on the road. It could be there will be fewer accidents and fewer deaths with autonomous vehicles, but the lives still lost might be different lives than if humans made the decision. And interactions between humans alone are messy. How is a poor pre-programmed driverless vehicle supposed to cope with the other vehicles that still have people at the wheel? This creates liability dilemmas. Gunkel says the vehicle might hold some responsibility for the accident, and software developers could be liable decades after the fact.
Microsoft created the Tay AI chatbot and put it on Twitter, and within 6 hours of interacting with users online, the chatbot became a raving neo-Nazi racist, right? And Microsoft then pulls the chatbot offline and tries to apologize for what went wrong. But Microsoft never took full responsibility for the hate speech.
Gunkel says Microsoft apologized for not anticipating the hate speech, but said the responsibility was with users who taught the chatbot its abhorrent responses, or the responsibility of the bot itself. The 2008 financial collapse attracted similar arguments because of algorithm-driven trading. At this point, lawyers nationwide probably have gleams in their eyes over how these sorts of questions will play out in court on autonomous vehicles. Driverless vehicles could keep older people independent longer. They could lead to more compact living. In fact, Gunkel says that's already happening in urban areas with Uber and Lyft. Adoption of the new tech could result in more diffuse living as well, because commutes can be productive when you don't have to pay attention to driving.
Like you see with commuters on trains, you know, you have circumstances where people are taking correspondence courses by, you know, doing online learning. You have people who have written novels while they are commuting by rail. Will we see similar sorts of things happen with regards to passengers and vehicles that are autonomously driven? I don't know. I mean, they may just end up playing video games the entire time.
Estimates of when whatever happens will happen are all over the map, anywhere from 10 years to 60, till whenever, Gunkel says, there will be a lot of experiments and small-scale rollouts before the big picture changes.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. We're exploring the coming of autonomous vehicles. Government planners believe autonomous vehicles can reshape communities in ways we've never seen before. But the fledgling technology creates a challenge because the technology still poses far more questions than answers. GLT's Eric Stock poses some of those questions to planners in McLean County.
The McLean County Regional Planning Commission analyzes all kinds of data, including trends on population, industry, and consumer habits, to help guide communities in how they prepare for the future. Its analysis helps communities determine things like land use, infrastructure, and other needs to foster sustainable growth. Transportation is a major component of regional planning in a country which has almost as many cars as it has people.
If we had the storied visit from the Martians or whomever, and they were sort of looking down at the planet and evaluating what was here, they would assume the cars were in charge. Can we change that?
Jennifer Six has been overseeing transportation issues for the McLean County Regional Planning Commission for 17 years. She envisions autonomous vehicles will someday be part of a vast electronic grid where cars on the road communicate with this network and with each other. Think air traffic control, only on pavement and without the human controllers. Six says it remains to be seen whether such a grid would be managed by the federal government, just as air travel is in the United States and most other countries, or whether private companies would beat them to the punch.
I think we've seen in the private sector some attempts to demonstrate the kind of model, the kind of software that would be required to operate in a larger sort of networked environment. I'm not sure anyone really understands yet how exactly that would work.
The grid concept is intended to make these driverless cars less likely to crash. If proven true, traffic lanes could be narrowed, what the industry calls a road diet. That could lead to more space for communities to plan for industry, green space, or other amenities. There's one dimension to autonomous vehicle technology that could dramatically change how communities are built. It's centered on the concept that these cars that ferry us from here to there wouldn't have to occupy space in parking lots for long periods of time.
Facilities that would ordinarily draw a lot of cars, shopping malls, concert venues, all the kinds of places where ordinarily you would expect to need a lot of parking, even if on a day-to-day basis it's not used that much, maybe we don't need it at all. Or maybe we need far fewer slots in those parking lots because most people's cars will trundle off and go somewhere else.
If a car could be programmed to pick us up at the store and drive us home, would we even need to have a vehicle in our possession around the clock? Ride-sharing has already become a growth industry because of companies like Uber and Lyft, but could enter a new dimension if autonomous vehicle technology prompts more motorists to untether themselves from their vehicle. Expanded ride-sharing could also provide an opportunity for public transportation firms such as Connect Transit to expand service. Connect Transit General Manager Isaac Thorne says he views the potential for self-driving vehicles to be a potential growth area for public transportation. He says even if the technology makes ride-sharing programs like Uber and Lyft more popular, there will always be a need for mass transit on a larger scale.
Public transit is going to stay because you cannot move that many people in an autonomous vehicle, even if it does carry six over a 40-foot bus that carries 70 passengers an hour.
Thorne imagines autonomous vehicles would enable the transit agency to reach more lower-density areas. He acknowledges public transportation could reduce its costs by removing drivers, noting their transit service's biggest expense, but he doesn't envision that on-bus staff are going away entirely.
It's going to shift your needs as far as labor, but you're also going to need probably a customer attendant there on that vehicle to make sure people are seated okay, make sure there's no issues on the vehicle.
Connect Transit employs 90 full-time drivers among a staff of 130 employees. Thorne says he's had discussions about driverless technology with Bloomington Normal and the Regional Planning Commission, but he warns it's too soon to plan when so little is known about how or when the technology will emerge.
I think one of the misconceptions is people think this is right around the corner. I think we're 10, 15 years off from this being a true reality. And there's other states out in Arizona, California, Nevada that are much further along in testing autonomous vehicles than we are here in Illinois.
Government leaders in Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County say they are excited about what autonomous vehicle technology might bring, but they tap the brakes before discussing its potential impacts. Normal's Public Works Director Wayne Aldrich is a former project manager for the Illinois Department of Transportation and has been in transportation for 35 years. He believes it'll take a driverless vehicle overhaul to make driving roads safe enough to allow roads to be downsized.
That may be something in the far future with truly autonomous vehicles, but in my opinion, if you insert any other element in there, like a partially autonomous vehicle or something else, it may cause problems.
In the meantime, Aldrich imagines a multi-lane road, such as interstates, could dedicate some of their lanes to exclusively autonomous traffic, similar to carpool lanes. He believes if Public Works adopts driverless technology, it would likely start with garbage and recycling trucks. He notes Bloomington and Normal already use sidearm loaders to lift the trash and recycling containers, and cameras and sensor technology is already available for these types of vehicles.
There's that kind of technology out there. So a vehicle being running its own route and sensing that there's a trash receptacle out there and picking up a trash receptacle, I think that's very possible.
Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason says city and regional planners have engaged in preliminary discussions regarding the technology. He says even with all the logistical challenges and unanswered questions, driverless cars, he says, will likely prove to be worth the investment.
It's probably dependent on who you ask, but it's emerging technology. It's in its infancy, and it's just one of those that you know it's coming, and there's obviously benefits, or else it wouldn't be gaining the momentum that I think it is.
McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre says he's grateful for Rivian Automotive's emergence in the autonomous vehicle landscape, but says the county is likely still years away from needing to accommodate the technology on a broader scale.
The one good thing about it, we're here in a community that's one of the forerunners of doing this type of thing. And so, yeah, there might be a point in time when we do that. I don't see it as next year until they're up and running. And then it's going to be longer than that till the autonomous vehicles are actually taking effect.
While government planners are eager to see how driverless technology could create new opportunities for land use redevelopment, the Regional Planning Commission's Jennifer Six acknowledges much of these changes rely on changing the habits of the American consumer in a country that has had a long love affair with cars and the power and convenience they offer.
This country has had a century of adapting to and embracing the personal automobile, the car that sits in your garage until you need it and then faithfully does what you want it to do. That's going to be tough to break. I think a lot of people are going to realize that that's much more deeply ingrained in our view of how we travel than we realized.
Six says the Regional Planning Commission has been involved in discussions with the Illinois Department of Transportation to bring driverless vehicle testing to Central Illinois. She considers this to be an ideal setting because of the vehicle testing that Rivian's predecessor, Mitsubishi Motors, conducted when it operated its plant in Normal. I'm Eric Stock.
America's fascination with cars dates back to Henry Ford's Model T. From there, realities turned to wishes when the Jetsons' 1960 cartoon made the flying car a vision for the future. Today's cars don't fly, yet, but they might soon drive themselves. Is America's love of cars enough to let go of the wheel? GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with residents of Bloomington Normal about their hopes and hesitations regarding self-driving cars.
Todd Chapman is a resident of Bloomington. He says he's looking forward to seeing more self-driving cars on the road for safety reasons. By taking the wheel out of the hands of people, he says that leaves less room for human error.
We were on a family vacation last summer driving on the interstate, and there was a semi-truck that just didn't see us next to it and just merged over, and we managed to just kind of go on the shoulder real briefly. It wasn't an accident. We weren't that much in danger or anything, but I remember thinking that, you know, a self-driving car wouldn't have made that move and wouldn't have veered into our lane because they would have known we were right there.
Chapman says he knows a couple of people who rode in self-driving cars, and he's looking forward to his first ride. But what about his kids? Would Chapman willingly place his children in an autonomous vehicle to take them to school?
Not yet. Maybe once I have more experience or some experience in these types of vehicles, I might be more comfortable. But down the road, sure, that's likely to be a reality, but not quite there yet.
That seems to be a common answer. People are excited for their first ride, but hesitate when asked about putting their loved ones in the computer-driven car. Normal resident Robin Levine has an 18-year-old son. He says the technology needs more work first before he would feel comfortable having his son ride in one. But Levine says he looks forward to the day he calls or orders a self-driving car to take him to work. Daniel McClure is a resident of Normal. He considers himself to be very pro self-driving vehicles. He says they're safer than the human driver alternative.
As humans, we can only focus on one thing at a time. Self-driving cars, on the other hand, will have the potential for being able to focus on everything at one time. And so the limitations that humans kind of introduce into the equation of car driving is a limitation that, you know, computers, they just won't have.
Earlier this year, Uber suspended its self-driving car service in Arizona after one of its company's autonomous vehicles hit and killed a pedestrian. McClure says loss of life is always concerning, but that people should remember car accidents are the third largest cause of fatalities in the U.S.
One person perishing from a self-driving car is in itself very sad and something that we need to look at to prevent. However, there are so many other people that perish every day needlessly because intoxication, just simply being distracted from a radio, phones, and whatnot, or even just other things on the road.
The Centers for Disease Control puts vehicle accidents behind heart disease and cancer for the leading cause of death in the U.S. Chapman agrees, citing another CDC statistic that over 30,000 people die each year in the U.S. as a result of those accidents. He says Uber's self-driving car accident is cause for some hesitation, but
I don't think it's a cause for panic, but it's a realization that the technology is not 100% there yet. There's going to be some likely other incidents like this along the way.
Chapman says the public needs to think realistically and realize that accidents are going to happen. But he says self-driving cars are an improvement from human error.
Let's get it as good as we possibly can and then figure out, you know, how to make it as safe as possible. There's never going to be, or it's going to be a long time before there's zero highway deaths, whether it's self-driving cars or human drivers.
Chapman says the unpredictable nature of humans is likely too much for the computers inside self-driving cars to understand. He says that will no doubt lead to difficulties, but it doesn't mean to stop improving the technology.
I don't know if there's, you know, with artificial intelligence, if they can start learning how to predict how humans may behave unpredictably, whatever, if that even makes sense. But the technology is becoming so advanced, I would think that there's going to be some improvement in that aspect.
But Chapman says some of that responsibility falls on the human. He says people need to be aware that this technology is out there and drive and act differently as a result. Levine expresses similar sentiments. He says as self-driving cars are slowly introduced to more towns and cities, they should be clearly marked to notify nearby human and drivers and pedestrians. So will self-driving cars make life easier for Levine?
Oh, undoubtedly. Not having to worry about car maintenance, not having to worry about where I'm going to park the car. All I have to do is wake up in the morning and probably go to the computer and say, I need a car to take me from home to work. And magically, this shows up and takes me there.
He also notes possible safety improvements when it comes to driving in inclement weather.
On days like this with the snow out there, I just would assume that I have to worry about all the potential things that could go wrong with driving, the slippery roads, the other drivers. I'd much rather leave it to a computer, which is very precise.
Along with increased safety, self-driving vehicles allow passengers to take time usually spent driving and devote it to other tasks. McClure is a landscape designer. He says he spends a chunk of time each day driving to meetings with customers and clients.
I find myself just constantly annoyed at the amount of time that is lost every day that I could be even behind the wheel, but doing some preparing for a meeting, doing some reading on the topics of the day.
McClure adds accessibility to that list of positives, noting that autonomous vehicles add mobility to elderly populations who are no longer medically able to drive and lower income populations who might not be able to afford a car. I'm Mary Cullen.
We're wrapping up 2018 at GLT and want to take a minute to thank everyone who's contributed to this year. Whether you're a longtime supporter or you just came on board with your first-time contribution, you are making a difference for your public radio station. If you haven't contributed yet this year, there's still time to let us know how much you value the news and entertainment you find on air and online. Make your year-end contribution right now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Residents of Bloomington Normal say they are pro self-driving cars, but does that mean drivers' love of the road is dead? Pop culture has been a superhighway for autos during the 20th century. Getting behind the wheel was a cool expression of the American dream. Can driverless cars ever capture the romance of the road? GLT's culture maven talks with arts correspondent Laura Kennedy.
The cars we drive also drive our creative impulses, manifesting as a dominant force in popular culture. The cars we drive are an extension of our dreams and our identities. But as cars change in the future and computers take the wheel, will the anxiety of giving up control impact our culture? Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University, is GLT's culture maven and says the future could be grim. The car as we know it now distills a number of American values, including freedom. Zeck says those values spill into our entertainment and reveal our ongoing adoration of the car.
You know, whenever somebody talks about car songs, I always think of Tracy Chapman's Fast Car.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere.
Not only is it a great song and she's terrific, but cars are for us the possibility of escape. Cars are in our imagination and also in practicality, they're a means of escape. So that song, You Got a Fast Car, it's, we're in a terrible situation, we're in love, the car's going to help us get away. I think that's very much part of the American imagination.
But cars are changing in our world. Cars right. are becoming driverless, they're becoming automated. As cars become something new in our lives, how does that change our relationship to cars? And how will we find that reflected in pop culture?
I think, at least right now, in terms of driverless cars, in pop culture, it's going to feed into disaster films, I'm sure.
Kind of like Speed, only you're in a car and somebody's
exactly,
taking over your car.
Exactly. So I think that this vehicle, which is so designed around the human body and its capacities, right? The average height of a human, the average leg length, figuring out ways to make adjustments within that, within this little cockpit that you sit in. So I think that what we're going to see in films is enormous anxiety about the human equation being taken out of the relationship to the operation of the car.
Because we're feeling that in our real lives. I love the idea of a driverless car, but that's at the same time, the control freak in me is like, I'm a little anxious about that.
Absolutely. And it seems wrong. There's
yes.
there's a way in which it just seems not, it seems like something's being taken away as opposed to something being given to us, right? So I'm sure 20 years from now we'll talk about what
we'll laugh at ourselves.
Yeah. You asked about cars and popular culture, and I went straight to music, but of course cars and movies are hugely important. I think we largely associate them with teen culture, road movies, that sort of thing. But who would James Bond be without his Aston Martin? There are lots of ways in which cars and movies have become iconic. But, you know, when you ask me what's the first one I think of Suspicion.
You mean the Alfred Hitchcock movie?
Yeah.
When Cary Grant is driving the car and Joan Fontaine is there and they're going along these winding roads and she thinks he's going to kill her.
Uh-huh. That's the very first one that comes to mind.
That's interesting.
First of all, because it's a brilliantly shot scene.
It is.
And it's incredible how, without really any dialogue, Hitchcock creates this great tension. And we don't know whether he's going to kill her or not, except that he's Cary Grant, so he's not going to kill her. Yeah, so that's the first one that comes to mind, which also is the other thing, cars as weapons, which unfortunately we have seen way too dramatically in the last few years. But the car as freedom, car, you know, all that sounds very nice. Cars are also dangerous. And I don't just mean dangerous like when something goes wrong. They are vehicles that we have seen weaponized. And when you add the ability for them to operate themselves to that, that gets back to my notion that what we'll see in the movies is disaster situations, horror situations.
I have to wonder how they would adapt the Fast and the Furious series to a driverless car.
Faster, furiouser, and foolisher.
So again, looking to the future,
mm-hmm.
and you feel that the driverless vehicle will manifest itself in pop culture with a certain level of anxiety. What about beyond that? As we become more adapted to giving over control to the car and our relationship to the car changes, will we go back to how we felt about the car in the past, the whole freedom and that sort of thing? Will we never really lose that? Will our relationship to the car, how will that be depicted on the big screen 50, 60, 70, 100 years down the road?
Laura, by the time that happens, we're not going to be watching movies anymore. There's going to be something else going on neurologically that provides us that kind of stimulation. That's what I think.
So as cars change and our relationships to cars change, can you find something from our past that might be similar to how things are going to be changing with the cars? We will no longer be behind the wheel, so our relationship to cars will change. When we look back to the past, is there something analogous?
Well, I don't think this is the most brilliant answer I've ever given to one of your questions, but I'm going to say the TV.
The TV?
Yeah, because when we went to the remote control, our relationship with our viewing patterns became profoundly different. Americans stopped getting off the couch, stopped having a physical relationship with the television set in a certain way. All their adjustments were done through the remote. Stopped watching programs and commercials and everything all the way through. So the flow, people would talk about flow when they did television studies in the 60s and 70s. They don't talk about that so much anymore because people are running all over.
People are hopscotching.
Hopscotching all over the map. They're time shifting, all of that.
If they're watching television at all rather than streaming everything.
Well, there's that.
Yes.
I mean, I'm one of those folks, right? When the remote control came along, that was the beginning of a series of technological advances that changed what viewing was in houses and changed, therefore, our physical relationship to it. And then, you know, it opened up it was kind of the beginning of this whole way in which we do everything by remote control now.
So how long does it take for a cultural icon to reach cultural obsolescence?
It doesn't take very long. I mean,
not these days.
Right, can use the rotary phone example. Even in the last 50 years, we've seen lots of things change in that way.
So now we're moving into the automated car world.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, in pop culture, we've seen examples of automated vehicles. The Batmobile. Now, I mean, we might have some anxiety about giving away that power, that control. But who could say the Batmobile is not cool and doesn't want to ride in the Batmobile? We all want to do that. Maybe the Batmobile is really what helps to make the driverless car ultimately cool now.
For 5 minutes.
For 5 minutes.
Okay. I mean, for 5 minutes. Because the Batmobile is not as cool if you look at it now as it was in 1968. So for 5 minutes, I think it'll be cool. Cool like a novelty cool.
That's Sherry Zick, Interim Dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear more from the Culture Maven about America's love for cars at our website, WGLT.org.
One, two, three.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Brian Denham, Mary Cullen, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.